It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why, after 16 years of below average levels, water in the Great Lakes seems to be on the rise.
First, a decade ago this month, the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park became the then largest protected sea area in the world.
The reef spans 215,000 square miles. It runs a distance similar to that between Boston and Havana. It's visible from space, and it's one of the world's seven natural wonders.
The reef has an always-inspired awe, though. When Captain Cook famously wrecked off the coast of Queensland in the late 18th century, he described it as little more than an insane labyrinth, the likes of which he had never seen before.
In his new book, The Great Barrier Reef, From Captain Cook to Climate Change, Ian McCallman describes the cultural and ecological significance of the reef. What was once a trap for seafarers became a natural wonder, and then a casualty of climate change.
Ian McCallman joins us now from Sydney, Australia. He's a fellow of the Royal Historical Society and previously authored Darwin's Armada. Ian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with Wisconsin.
Great to have you here. Is the Great Barrier Reef on track to become extinct?
Yeah, I think it is, actually. I mean, it's so horrible to have to say it, but I can't see how, unless there's some dramatic change occurs that nobody's yet been able to predict, that we can prevent it from being effectively dead within 20 to 50 years at the outside.
And I'm wondering how you're measuring that with such a vast expanse of coral reef that we're talking about. Why is this threat impending upon us?
Well, coral reefs are incredibly fragile creatures, and you know, they are compared to the little tiny yellow canaries that miners used to take down in the mines in the 19th century to detect poison gases that no one else could smell. And in a way, the reefs are the canaries of climate change, as well as having other susceptibilities just to human pollution and sediment in the water and so on. But the main kind of casualty is through climate change, and climate change is smashing the reefs in three separate ways, at least. One is because we're getting wilder and more extreme weather, particularly cyclones coming more often and more severely, and of course they knock the reef around with tremendous seas that occur. But then there are two other major forces. I guess the most dramatic one is that the sea is getting hotter, and corals have very little tolerance of increased heat. In the case of barrier reef corals, 2 degrees will see them all completely bleach, and that's already happening. The third one, which is, in a way, it's the real elephant in the room for us all, and that is the fact that the oceans are becoming more acid. In effect, the oceans are being turned into carbonic acid by absorbing all this CO2 and methane that's in the atmosphere. Mm. And when that happens, they start to dissolve limestone and anything to do with calcium in the seas, which includes plankton and ultimately krill. But it also includes corals, which are made of limestone. So they start to get brittle. They become unable to grow in an ordinary sort of way, and of course they then get knocked down by the forces of the sea.
Well, let's turn the clock back a little bit and talk about the origins of the reef. How did it come to be off the coast of Queensland?
Yeah, it's very similar to what happened off Florida, or at least so I believe. That is to say, a large part of the Queensland coast subsided very slowly. And as it subsided, the water got engulfed by water. But it remained fairly shallow so that corals could still experience light and so could grow. So as gently as the seas, as the ocean floor subsided, the corals grew up. So in effect, a great deal of the land, which is now the Great Barrier Reef's lagoon, was once where Aboriginal people hunted and lived.
And in your book, you take us back there. How did the Aboriginal people see the reef?
Well, it's a huge area, and Aboriginal clans are very small. So along the edge of the reef, there lived many, many different communities, most of them in close kind of relationship to the reef and to its sand beach and hinterland. They saw it as a nurturing mother, as the force that gave them energy and food and sustenance, and looked after them, and they looked after it. That was a kind of reciprocal arrangement, which kept the reefs in reasonable harmony for thousands and thousands of years before we came along.
Mm-hmm. When Captain Cook wrecked his ship in the Great Barrier in the late 18th century, he saw it, though, as an insane labyrinth. What was his experience like when he came upon it?
Yes, he hadn't realized he was actually sailing in the Barrier Reef, because it's a very big area, especially at the southern entrance where he first came in. You know, the major reef is of the outer barrier is about, we would say, 200 miles from the coast. So he just didn't know he was sailing in it. And then suddenly one night, in deep water, he suddenly hits this obstacle, and he immediately realizes it must be coral, because coral has this weird capacity, as he saw it, to grow up from nowhere. These huge kind of walls suddenly appeared out of the deep water. And once he'd been wrecked, and spent five weeks on the land, he looked out from the hills, and all he could see was reef upon reef upon reef, and then the outer reef right at the edge of it. And it looked literally like a labyrinth. That's what he described it as. He couldn't see any way to go forward or back without smashing his boat up again. Hmm. It was an absolute horror for him.
So what did he do?
Well, he inched his way through. Really, what they had to do was they had to test the depth with the leadsman who drops the lead in with rope on it or string on it, testing the depth. They had to do that continuously, and they also had to send a little boat in front of them all the time to find out where the channels were and test where they could go. So it was excruciatingly difficult and also tremendously dangerous, because imagine it being a kind of minefield. But the Endeavour, which I can testify, having sailed on it, is a tub, very, very difficult to manoeuvre. And so he had to sail through this minefield in a very, very awkward kind of boat, with no sense of what was going to come next, no maps to guide him. It was a prodigious act of seamanship.
We're talking with Ian McCalman about his new book, The Great Barrier Reef, From Captain Cook to Climate Change. 10 years ago this month, the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park became what was then the largest protected sea area in the world.
And you can join the program. Have you been to the Great Barrier Reef, seen it, maybe even tried to sail it? How would you describe what you saw? Or do you have a question about the history, the science, or the future of the reef? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
We're continuing our conversation with Ian McCalman about his new book, The Great Barrier Reef, From Captain Cook to Climate Change.
And you can join the conversation with your questions about the Great Barrier Reef, or if you've been lucky enough to be there to see it in person, we'd love to hear about your experience. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Ian, before the news, before the break, you were talking about the difficulty that some have had in navigating the area there. In light of the protections that would be around the Great Barrier Reef at this point, is there any restriction now on whether people can navigate those waters?
No, there's no restriction, Cynthia, but There is a problem because the Great Barrier Reef has become a kind of ocean highway. You know, by going through the reef, you can cut probably a very substantial time off going through, depending on where you're going, but in either direction, south or north. And so we do have these huge container ships trying to traverse a very, very difficult area. Of course, it's well signed and everything, but I mean, from time to time we do get boats going on the reef and then we get these oil spills. And one of the things that's very worrying about recent government policy is they're intensifying the traffic going through the reef, probably by a factor of 10, and that is going to make an oil spill in the future very, very likely.
Let's take a call from Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon. Probably about 12 years ago, I was fortunate enough to scuba dive on the Great Barrier Reef, and I was just blown away. It's such an amazing array of very colorful life there. But even at that time, we were noticing there were other issues with the reef that that I hadn't heard about yet, and the concerns were runoff from farming operations. Crown of thorns outbreak, which is a type of a sea star that eats the corals, and even tourism itself. They were warning, training us on how to not, as we're scuba diving, what to do to not damage the reefs. But there's even some impacts on that. I'd love to hear more comments, or I'd love to hear more about how those. If any of those issues have been addressed and what impacts they're currently having on the reef.
Ian McCalman?
That's a great question. Can I just pause for a minute, because you raised the very, very important issue of crown of thorn starfish. I mean, these are, as Mike, I think, said, are tremendously voracious creatures that eat the coral. And they are a natural phenomenon. They occur naturally in the reef. But what's happened is it seems to be two reasons. They've become a plague. An absolute tsunami of these creatures has occurred. And one of them is because of their natural predators having been fished away. But the second and major reason is that the little larvae that are expelled into the sea love pollution. And they're thriving in polluted waters. And we just can't stop these creatures. 40% of the existing total coral cover has been eaten by crown of thorn starfish. That's just one of them. The other two points, I'll just quickly say something about. It is true that wherever there is a resort, however well managed, the corals are to some extent damaged. I've just been doing an exploration myself in the research regions and found that is the case. And of course, runoff is a real problem. We have a sugar industry which has felled a lot of the forests and grows sugar all along the banks, and they use fertilizer, and that nitrogen runs into the water and it damages the corals. Yeah. So those are very important factors, ancillary factors to the big three of climate change.
Mm-hmm. I was curious about your thoughts on whether or not tourism does more to harm or to help the issues facing the Great Barrier Reef.
Well, I think tourism is an absolute necessity, and I think what we should be doing, and indeed what I'm trying to do working with some communities up there, is really, really foster ecotourism. Because it's not only that we have this fantastic reef, we've also got the oldest rainforests in the world, 46 million years old, that date back to when we were part of Gondwanaland, and they are these magnificent rainforests that fringe the reef. So we have these two great environments, and I think tourists should be encouraged to come there. It's a legitimate form of revenue for the area, which is, after all, a huge country. But the key thing is to really promote ecotourism rather than tourism of the kind that produces pollution or damages the corals.
Mm-hmm. Sherry in La Crosse joins us now. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. Yeah, I was listening to your show, and in February we got a wonderful chance to go see the Great Barrier Reef and the rainforest, actually. We took a canopy walk through the rainforest there, and it was a wonderful, fantastic trip. I grew up watching Jacques Cousteau, and it was like surreal being actually snorkeling in these areas. It was a smaller group, and I think they did a lot to, you know, make sure we didn't do any harm to the coral reef. And, you know, the problems they were having at that time was the jellyfish. We had to wear stinger suits to be safe and stuff, but it was just a fantastic time.
And what was your first reaction when you first saw the reef?
I guess I expected it to be a little more colorful, but, you know, once I got adjusted to the sights and everything, it was just fantastic, the fish, and, you know, we saw some sharks, and my fiancé saw a turtle, and it was just fantastic. I just really had a great time.
Thanks, Jerry. Well, Ian, talk a little bit about how the reef's preservation movement first began.
Yeah, that's a great story, because I think it's a story of hope. It really began in the 1970s or late 60s when a group of, well, just ordinary citizens, I mean, a poet, a painter, and a forester from that region got together really and founded a wildlife preservation committee, because they were really worried about the fact that the state government of Queensland was developing in a completely unrestricted way. And not only that, as it subsequently turned out, they had zoned 80% of the reef for oil mining. And they were also mining the coral itself to use for fertilizer and concrete. I mean, it was, you know, an absolutely terrifying moment for this wonder of the world. And this group of people got together and they created a popular campaign, which in the end, changed the opinions of people up in Queensland and right around the country. And it's that led to it becoming a marine park and eventually a World Heritage marine park, though that is threatened at the moment.
Yeah, and can you tell us a little bit about some of the people who were behind the preservation movement? I know that Charlie Vernon plays quite a role in your book.
Yeah, Charlie is a fantastic guy. I'm just reading his draft autobiography, so I hope it comes out, because it's a riveting story. He was a coral scientist, actually the first professional reef scientist as late as 1972, the first professional scientist. But he fell completely in love with the reef, and with coral reefs generally, and he's dived 7,000 hours on the Great Barrier Reef, and he's named and discovered more than 20% of the world's corals. And it was him more than anybody else who alerted us to the fact that the reefs in Australia and all over the world are dying. That is to say, reefs which contribute to 2/3 of the biodiversity of all of our oceans are dying. So it's a very serious matter. And Charlie has been one of the people who's campaigned and continues to campaign to persuade people what an incredible and important heritage this is for everyone on the globe.
And I know that he's trying to make it his mission as well to inspire scientists to use their influence to get people to really care about this and be aware of it. But at the same time, I know that you're concerned that people will take a more fatalist approach and throw their hands in the air and say, well, there's nothing we can do. What advice do you have for avoiding that that fatalist mentality in our last minute here?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And, you know, it isn't something I have an easy solution to. But I'd like to sort of cite, by way of an example, a little community on the reef that I'm working with at the moment. They're in a lovely little resort called Mission Beach, which is south of Cairns, people would know. And Mission Beach has been hit by two successive cyclones of prodigious strength, 4 years apart. So the community was smashed to pieces once, and then they pulled themselves together, rebuilt to cyclone standards, and then the next cyclone hit, and it was much more severe than any cyclone that had happened before. So they once again were smashed to pieces. And this is a community where the coral meets the rainforest. It's a very, and it's also a place where the greatest diversity of sort of rainforest creatures is, including the cassowary.
Ian, thank you so much for joining us today. Unfortunately, we're out of time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure. We've been speaking with Ian McCalman. His new book is The Great Barrier Reef, From Captain Cook to Climate Change. It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we find out what the discovery of a lost J.R.R. Tolkien recording reveals about the beloved Lord of the Rings author's life and thoughts.
First, after 16 years of below-average water levels in the Great Lakes, we're finally seeing somewhat of a turnaround, and that could be good news for boaters and shippers.
Thanks to a variety of factors, water levels are on the rise, with Lakes Superior, Michigan, and Huron at levels about a foot higher than a year ago. So what's behind the rising waters, and will the trend continue?
Joining us now to talk more about this story is Erin Coy. She's the O'Brien Fellowship intern at Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where she's been covering the Great Lakes. Erin, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, water levels are up in the lakes. How big of a rise have we seen? We've seen a foot in the last year, but how does that compare to, say, the last decade?
The last decade, we've been down. This might not sound like a big number, but jump at least. We've been down since 1998 at about 579 feet, and then now we're back to 709 feet, but about 2 years ago it was about 577, which 2 feet doesn't seem like a lot, but it's, if you put it into inches, 12 to 24 inches is a lot for the Great Lakes.
Yeah, and what accounts for that? Why are we seeing rises this year?
Well, this year we're in particular seeing rises because of all the ice that's been on the Great Lakes. Over 90% of the lakes this year were covered in ice, which is the second highest on record. And plus this early spring and into the summer, we've had about 18 inches of rain. That's mostly in the southeastern Wisconsin area, but it's probably pretty similar around the Great Lakes.
And as I understand it, having so much ice, which covered about 92% of the Great Lakes, has helped stave off water evaporation. But also cloud cover is a factor here, too. How has cloud cover been a factor?
Yes. According to one of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration researchers, he told us that for about 12 years now, there's been some low cloud coverage over the Great Lakes, which means more water is being evaporated and more water is moving out than is actually coming in. So that's been a huge factor in low lake levels.
And what will this mean for the way in which we have been using the Great Lakes? As I understand it, there may not be as much dredging necessary.
Yeah, we've had a lot of dredging for shipping canals, especially coming through the St. Lawrence Seaway into the Great Lakes, up through the Sault Ste. Marie locks into Lake Superior. There's had to be dredging done for the last few years to deepen those canals. This year we shouldn't have any deepening, mostly just maintenance and marinas for dredging, and that's about it.
And what does this mean for the local economy as far as the shipping industry goes?
Well, it means that ships can start carrying heavier loads. In the past few years, they've had to cut back on cargo loads because of that draft issue with the shallower waters. But now they can bulk up their loads again and start carrying more cargo in and out of the Great Lakes, which obviously increases our local economy. So that's a huge plus. But we don't have any solid numbers on that yet.
In what ways will we start to see the impact of that shift in the local economy through the increase of the shipping industry?
One of the biggest cargoes coming in and out of the Great Lakes is grains. Like I said, I don't have any numbers on that, but we'll definitely see some more heavier loads coming in and out, which means it's a beneficial factor towards the grain economy, especially in Wisconsin, because that's one of our biggest exports.
And I know the future is hard to predict here, but what do you foresee in terms of the Great Lake level measurements going forward, either in the next year or beyond 5-10 years?
Yeah,
will it continue to depend on the weather?
It will definitely continue to depend on the weather. Great Lakes levels are very cyclical, so they go up and down every year. Depends, like I said, on the ice temperatures and the rain we get throughout the year and the evaporation. But right now, I know that forecasted through August and into the fall, levels are supposed to remain above average. I don't really know predictions 5-10 years in the future, but again, cyclical patterns have shown that this will continue to happen, this deep dive and then returning to normal.
So would you classify this as good news, or could you even say it's is not necessarily bad news, but it is cloaked in a greater conversation about the way in which the weather has impacted the state of Wisconsin in the last year between polar vortexes and some other strange weather phenomena.
Yeah.
So what does that mean in the bigger picture of things?
I can't say definitely, but I know if we have more winters like we have the last year, not necessarily the polar vortexes, but if we have this continued very decent ice cover across the lakes, levels I think will definitely remain above average. I'm not an expert on the levels, obviously, so I can't guarantee that, but the cyclical nature of it is if we continue having winters like the last couple years, then we'll be good.
Mm-hmm. And what do you continue to look out for as you continue to work with and research the Great Lakes?
Well, we have a couple big stories coming up, not necessarily on lake levels, but the Great Lakes are a big news lately, especially with the shipping industry and the invasive species that are happening. So in the next couple of weeks, next month or so, we'll have some big stories coming up on the Great Lakes.
Great. And as you look at this story specifically, is it possible that things will return to us? I know that you said you're not quite sure what normal is supposed to be. Is that because we've seen levels that are below average and above average, and we don't really have a sense of what's normal anymore?
Yeah, I think that is a sense. I mean, I grew up on the Great Lakes my entire life, so I've seen fluctuating waters since I was a kid. I don't know what's normal. I don't know if anyone now knows what's normal, especially with the deep dive last year to being a record low, coming back up almost 2 feet this year, 1 to 2 feet this year, and being back above average, which is a huge jump.
Mm-hmm. Well, Erin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Erin Coy has been covering the Great Lakes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
And we'd like to hear your experiences of the Great Lakes. If you have property on the lakes, been vacation, been swimming, do you see higher water levels this year? Have you seen low water levels in previous years? How has that affected your life? Or if your livelihood depends on the lake levels. Like to hear from you, too. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, send us a message on the Central Time Facebook page, or email talk@WPR.org. Middle Earth fans have long speculated about the real meaning of The Lord of the Rings and whether its author, J.R.R. Tolkien, in fact, maybe saw himself as a bit of The Hobbit.
A lost Tolkien recording discovered over 20 years ago but kept under wraps until recently is shedding light on some of the mysteries surrounding Tolkien and shows a rarely seen side of the beloved fantasy author.
With us now is Noble Smith. He's a self-proclaimed Tolkien nerd and author of The Wisdom of the Shire and Sons of Zeus. He blogs about all things Tolkien at shirewisdom.com, and he's one of a few people who has heard this rare recording so far. Noble, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us the story of this lost Tolkien recording. Where did it come from? When did it surface?
Well, Tolkien had this wonderful party that was put on for him in 1958 in Rotterdam. And it was the only party of its kind. It was like a Hobbit festival. And he went there, and he got off the boat, and he kind of did a pub crawl before he got to the party. So he was a little bit in his cups by the time he started speaking, which is great because he sounded just like Bilbo before he gave his big 11-y-first birthday speech, this famous scene from The Fellowship of the Ring. And so anyway, a lot of people, this talk was sort of legendary, but there was no transcript of it. And there was just a little portions of his speech in his notes that his son came into possession after he died. So nobody really knew what he said for sure. So about 20 years ago, this guy named René Van Rossumberg tracked down the man who was in charge of recording things at this hall in Rotterdam, and found the old magnetic tapes in an old kind of moldy box in his basement.
And he held on to it for a while. If I can make a Lord of the Rings Hobbit analogy, it was his precious. He didn't want to share it with the world quite yet.
He did. He said that he was like Smaug the dragon. He sat on it for about 20 years. And then he was going to sell it to the BBC, but some Middle Earth fanatics found out about that he was in possession of it, and now it's sort of owned by the Middle Earth Network, which is a group of people in the United States. And what they want to do is clean up the recordings and make them available for the public.
So you've heard this. We can't hear it quite yet. Do they have an ETA of when the public can give a listen?
I think it'll probably be sometime in the fall. They're going to do a Kickstarter campaign, and you can learn more about it at mymiddleearth.com.
And now you have listened. You're a huge fan of J.R.R. Tolkien. What did you take away from his speech at his, well, it wasn't really his 11-y-first birthday, but it was like that?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan, and I wrote this book called The Wisdom of the Shire, which is kind of how to live like a hobbit. And the guy who runs the Middle Earth Network, or one of the people that runs it, a guy named Mark Ostley, had read my book. And he loved it and loved the kind of message. And when he heard this Tolkien recording, the Rotterdam recording, he was blown away. And he said that I had to hear it because the message that Tolkien delivers in this speech was essentially the message of my book. And so when he sent me a music file that I just downloaded to iTunes, and I listened to it, and of course welled up with tears. And it was just so beautiful, first of all, to hear Tolkien's voice, kind of in a way that nobody has ever heard him before. Very jovial and just cracking jokes and talking, referring to everybody in the audience as my dear hobbits. And the message of his speech is incredibly deep.
And what is that message?
Well, that the hobbits of the world need to stand up and fight against the Sarumans who are taking over the world. And if you've read the books, you know that Saruman is the evil wizard who, at the end of the books, kind of invades Hobbiton and corrupts it and tries to destroy the Hobbit way of life. So what's so amazing about this is 1958, okay? And already Tolkien, who is sort of like one of the modern environmentalists, I mean, he whenever he saw pollution or industrialization run rampant, he called it orcery. He hated it. He thought it was like a product of the orcs. And he hated to see trees cut down. I think one of the reasons he wrote The Lord of the Rings was out of this profound love of trees, and that's reflected in the Ents. But he also states what he believes is the theme of The Lord of the Rings. And you're just going to have to wait until the recording comes out, because I can't spill the beans on that yet, or I'll get in big trouble.
But the gist is, and people have read this message, and I think you pointed out in your book, this questioning that of the idea that progress is always good, that technology is always good, and questioning of authority and the corrupting influence of power. It seems like that is a key theme that people have taken out of The Lord of the Rings. Did you get that feel from this speech?
Oh, yeah. Tolkien, in his letter, says that he hated the fact that the men with mustaches and bombs were ruling the world. And, you know, if you kind of imagine the sort of Victorian-looking guy with the big handlebar mustaches and, you know, a giant ship, you know, heading off to blast some poor country into oblivion, he despised that. And he had gone through World War One, had caught trench fever in the front lines. So many of his friends were dead by the end of this war. And there are reflections of that in The Lord of the Rings. But he really wanted people to stand up. In one of the final chapters of The Fellowship of the Ring, or The Lord of the Rings, is a chapter called The Scouring of the Shire. And it's about how the hobbits come back to the Shire and they defeat Saruman. And one of the things they do is they find that he's imposed all of these ridiculous rules. And so the hobbits see the rules, you know, posted into these guardhouses, and they just rip them off the wall and tear them in half. That's how they felt about that.
An inspiration for the anarchist everywhere, in a way.
And Tolkien himself joked that he was sort of an anarchist.
Well, it seems like, I mean, the whole or most of Lord of the Rings is the confrontation with Sauron, this ultimate evil, you know, nothing good, super powerful thing. Tolkien says, okay, yeah, we got rid of that. But these pettier evils, these more mundane evils are the ones we got to watch out for here in the real world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you look at some of the minor characters in the story, like Grima Wormtongue, you know, the horrible...
lackey.
Lackey to Saruman, who corrupts Theoden. And Saruman himself, who was supposed to be a great and high-minded Astari wizard, but he too was corrupted by this quest for power. And the things that he does in Hobbiton when Saruman moves in, he does things like builds factories that just belt smoke into the air. Nobody knows what they actually make. And, you know, a lot of times I think that we've lost our connection to the earth. And in the beginning of The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien says that the hobbits had this deep and abiding connection with the earth. And I think that's something that we can strive to kind of recapture.
Getting back to the setting of this speech that we're going to hear a recording of later this year, if Tolkien were a fantasy author today, he'd be expected to do this hundreds of times a year at conventions around the world. How unique was an event like this for an emerging rock star of the emerging fantasy genre?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, it was a one-off. I mean, he never did it again. And he hadn't done it before this. I mean, it was a real thrill for him to be there. To see all there was a menu there was hobbit food, and it was kind of hilarious because they had things like vegetables of goldberry and egg salad a la Barleyman Butterbur and maggot soup, which was named after one of the characters, Farmer Maggot,
but not literally with maggots, hopefully.
Yeah, it doesn't sound very good, but he loved it. He had so much fun and wrote about it in his letters about what it.
Noble, are you still there?
I'm still there, yeah.
Okay. And so one thing I wanted to ask, did Tolkien think of himself as kind of a hobbit come to life?
He did see himself as a hobbit come to life. He really did. I mean, it was, he said that he was a hobbit in everything but stature. He loved the countryside, and he loved gardening, and hanging out with his friends and smoking his pipe and drinking and eating good food and being with his family. He really was like a hobbit. And when you hear this recording, you'll just be blown away at how similar he sounds to Bilbo.
And he reads, you write, a poem in Elvish. What was it like to hear the creator of this imagined language read a poem in that language?
Oh, yeah. It's just gorgeous to hear. He had such a mellifluous, beautiful voice. People who took his classes said that he could turn a lecture hall into a mead hall, which means, you know, fun and excitement. And, you know, he would make language come to life. He was a philologist and loved words. So when he reads this in Elvish or speaks it in Elvish, he sounds like one of the elves. And then he translates it into English, which is great. And if you go to my article in the Huffington Post, you can actually read the English version.
Well, Noble, thank you so much for joining us. And when this audio is available, maybe we can hear that Elvish poem on the air. Thanks again for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
That was Noble Smith. He's the author of The Wisdom of the Shire, talking about some recordings of J.R.R. Tolkien that'll be out later this year.